We have entered into the liturgical season of Lent. It strikes me that this is a relatively new thing for some people. A liturgical calendar basically has periods of feasting and fasting and normal times throughout the year. Feasting is celebration of God's movement for us. Christmas season is a season of feasting. Advent is fasting. Lent is fasting. And then Easter is feasting. And you can sort of get a sense of the balance back and forth. I grew up on the East Coast, and when I visited my mother always likes it when Lent comes around because the supermarkets put fish on sale because all of the Catholics are eating fish. And we kind of smiled about that because if I had to choose between beef and fish, I'd probably rather eat fish. So some of these traditional practices don't quite feel the same as they used to, but these practices of confession and lament and are sort of ways to withhold in order to train in righteousness. And then after Pentecost, you get this big green space of normal time, and that's usually when I go back to working through some books of the Bible. I've been working from a lectionary called the Narrative Lectionary. And in that Narrative Lectionary this year for Lent, we have a series of parables from Jesus. This week is the wedding banquet. Next week is the parable of the bridesmaid. Then you have the parable of the sheep and the goats. And really in Palm Sunday and Good Friday, you have this strange, conflicted sense of celebration or lament. In Palm Sunday, Jesus is received as king, but we find Jesus weeping. Good Friday seems to be like an absolute disaster, but we call it Good Friday because so much of our redemption happens in that strange package. These stories are sort of an arena that we are invited to enter into. We are the agents in that arena, and we are invited to explore our agency within this arena. What does it mean to think about Jesus' journey to the cross? What does it mean to think about Jesus entering Jerusalem? Now, we've talked about parables a number of times, and parables are interesting stories because, as Tom Holland noted with that quotation I've used quite a bit, they continue to be fresh. 2,000 years later, dramatically different cultural contexts, the parables of Jesus still grip us. One of the most interesting things about being a minister is the history of interpretation, because these stories expose deep patterns of relationships that are played out between ourselves and God across different times and places. As we read through the parable of the wedding banquet, many of you will, your imaginations will sort of fill in the characters who are part of this drama. And this has happened over the history of the church. And preachers have dealt with these questions in very different ways over the course of the church, that this parable gets applied in different ways, in different times, and different places. It begins like this. Jesus spoke to them again in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son." Now, already in that little verse, there's a lot of information. Remember, this kingdom of heaven is what Jesus keeps announcing. Sometimes the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's just about to break in on us. Sometimes we're told to seek the kingdom of heaven as if it's something far away, and we must exercise and exert ourselves to reach it. Sometimes Jesus announces that the kingdom of heaven is here. One of the best ways to think about it is at the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, where Jesus prays, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And so in many of these parables, as we saw in chapter 13, Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven. And here he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a king." who obviously has a son, who is the prince. And some of you might remember the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana back in the 1980s. Extraordinary event. Everybody in the world paid attention. They loved the pageantry. They loved the vestments. They loved the procession. They loved all of this. The king's son is going to marry. And obviously, that's exciting because, well, the prince will be king and the woman he marries will be a queen. And so he's going to hold a great event. And, well, if you were in England during the wedding of Charles and Diana, who would get seats in, well, Westminster Abbey to watch the ceremony? Probably the Earl of such and the Duke of this and the nobility of that and the Duchess of that. All of the important people in the nation would want to be there to have a front row seat at this grand celebration. But notice, it's a story. And so right away, we're sort of asked, okay, who is the king? Well, that seems kind of obvious. Isn't that God? Who is the son? Well, that seems kind of obvious. Isn't that the son of God? Isn't that the prince? Isn't that Jesus? Who is the bride? He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come. Well, yes, the great celebration is at hand. Come. But they refused to come. Can you for a moment think about the wedding of Charles and Diana and have people say, oh no, I won't go. Now, some of you knowing the whole trajectory of Charles and Diana and how that story went might think, yeah, I might think twice about that wedding after how everything turned out. But that's not this story. Because these are not citizens in a democracy. These are subjects of a king. The king owns everything. The people are his subjects. And the nobility, who are likely invited first, are those who have the most to gain and have the most to lose by offending the king, because they actually work with the king. That's how the land works. To not attend such a celebration is to insult, to defy, and it's a minor act of rebellion. But who's the bride? Well, there's a long history of interpretation about this. One way of looking at it very much imagines in the string of context with Jesus talking to the religious leaders of the day, Israel is perhaps the people invited who didn't come to it. Preachers throughout the century have seen the people who should be coming to the celebration of the great king in the church as not coming into it. This has been interpreted many different ways. So then he sent some more servants and said, tell those who have been invited that I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fattened cattle have been butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet. Now this is a second invitation. And generally speaking, there would not be a second invitation. You could never imagine that Queen Elizabeth would have to go out and write out second invitations to the nobility in England and mail them out and say, oh, by the way, just in case you didn't hear, Charles and Diana are getting married on this day. That would never happen. The Queen would never send out a second round of invitation. But this king, it seems, is patient and generous. He's reminding his subjects of their obligation and opportunity. It's very unusual. Some might see it as a sign of weakness. Are these subjects ignorant or rebellious? But they paid no attention and went off, one to his field and another to his business. Now, their seeming indifference Now, it's difficult for our modern democratic imaginations to comprehend, but the nobility has their land because the king gave it to them. The nobility has their fields because the king gave it to them. The nobility have their businesses because the king allows them to have it. So to turn from the king, to pay attention to the field and the business, is an insult. But there are others who are yet more insulting. The rest seized his servants, mistreated them, and killed them. Now, any of Jesus' audience listening to this would know exactly what would happen. They have seen Caesars, they have seen Herods, they know what kings do. There's a reason that when the king calls, you get there right away and you show up. And you don't insult the king, because when kings get angry, people die. So, what will the king do? The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their cities. These are cities in rebellion, and so the king comes and levels the city as a point to everyone else. I am a king. When I call, you better come. This is how the world works. Rebellions are put down. Rebels are utterly destroyed. But the king's response seems to be measured. He puts down the cities that have abused and mistreated his servants. Now, as I said before, there's a history of interpretation here, because Jesus will talk about the fact that God sent prophets to Israel. The prophets were messengers, and Israel mistreated and killed the prophets. This is a long tradition within Israel about sort of good Israel and bad Israel. So Jesus' audience would have understood this tradition that Jesus is leaning into. Other audiences would get it as well. Murderers are killed and their property and lineage destroyed. The indifferent? Well, what does the king do to them? But then the story takes an interesting twist. Then he said to his servants, "The wedding banquet is ready, but those I invited did not deserve to come." Those are the nobility. Those are the leaders. Those are the elite. Those are the wealthy. It's assumed that the king would have invited the nobility, those of high status, those with cities who could rebel, businesses and fields that needed tending. There's an obligation of glory that even the king must... had a cold last week. Even the king had to uphold. Can you imagine the wedding of Charles and Diana in an empty church? Can you imagine the feast of Charles and Diana? Tables set, food spread out, and nobody eating it. That's absolutely no way to celebrate the wedding of a prince. So the king has a problem. So he has an innovative solution to the problem. So go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone you find. Now again, think about this in the 80s in England. The Queen gets on TV. It seems none of the nobility wish to attend the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. Would anyone like to come? You would imagine, bang, the drop of the hat, everyone else in the nation would think, what fortune! I get to go to the wedding of a prince. I get to go and sit and feast. Now, this would be even more extraordinary in Jesus' day, when the average person did not have much opportunity to eat meat. The cattle have been slaughtered. The food is prepared. This will likely be, for a common person, the best meal they will ever eat in their life. So, go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone you find. Will they say yes? You better believe they'll say yes. They're going to come running. So the servants went out into the streets and gathered all the people they could find, the bad as well as the good, The wedding banquet was filled with guests. Well, even the fact that he went into the streets, who does he find in the streets? Workers, beggars, sojourners. They aren't the wealthy, the powerful, the beautiful, the moral. This is an unexpected opportunity that the lowly would not fail to pick up with gratitude and flee to him. Now you can tell already in this parable, it's already interpreting itself. We can see this in the story of Jesus. We can see that Jesus is always having conflict with the elite of the nation, but it's the lowly who are gathered to him and excited to be close to him and a part of them, and they think that they can't believe the outrageous fortune that they have received, that they get to participate. And so the wedding hall is filled. Everyone is happy to be there. They're all excited. And anyone who got this opportunity to have an invitation would put on the best clothes they could find. They would have their hair done up. All of the children would be wearing great outfits. And in they would come to enjoy something that they would not imagine they could ever enjoy as someone not being nobility. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man who was not wearing wedding clothes. He did not wash. He did not dress. He just sort of came in. He's not filled up with gratitude. He's not filled with the idea that he has just received a winning lottery ticket. So the king asked, "How did you get in here without wedding clothes, friend?" And the king, even here, is gracious. The man was speechless. Now, in the history of interpretation, this has caused a good deal of debate. Is this the righteousness that we should be clothed with in Christ when we're here at the wedding of the Lamb? Is this the gratitude we should have, being able to come and worship the great king? Preachers and interpreters go all over the place. It's like the weeds and the tares in that parable. The king is achieving glory, but rebellion can happen outside the banquet halls, and here's the thing. If rebels would insult him outside, how much more fun isn't it to get in the inside and spoil the wedding? Will the king allow that? No. Even the generous king will not allow rebellion outside or inside the hall. Even this rebel is given the opportunity to explain his lack of decorum and maybe mend his ways, but he doesn't take himself up on it. Then the king told the attendants, "Tie him hand and foot and throw him outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The kingdom is a glorious celebration. For a time, the king will tolerate indifference and rebellion in hopes that people will soon join the party. But there is an outer darkness, a locked door, to prevent the permanent disruption of the glory that must come. Jesus' parables are so full of these contrasts. We have a king. We have a prince. Who's the bride? Where is the bride? We have people who are invited. The noble, the proud, the wealthy, the smart, the brilliant, all the beautiful people. They're either indifferent or in open rebellion. And so the king opens it up to people for whom such an invitation is an outrageous fortune. And they come in eager, happy, ready. And the king says, "This is what we're looking for. We are going to enjoy the feast. I will not let my son's wedding be spoiled by people outside or inside." And then you get, and we'll see this again and again in the parables, this picture of hell, outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth. But these people didn't want to come. Well, they didn't want to come. But what is it to be on the outside when you can look on the inside and begin to recognize, why didn't I take the invitation? Why didn't I respond when I was invited? Why didn't I prepare myself for the great party? And then Jesus ends with a little saying, which, as Jesus often is, it's a little funny and cryptic. I've changed it a little bit from the NIV. I think it's more accurate to say, for many are called, but few are elect. And we hear that and we think, well, what does that mean? Isn't calling an election sort of the same thing? Well, kind of. But take a look at the story. This sort of bounces back and forth. The story does in our minds. And the story has bounced back and forth through the centuries that people have sort of been chewing on it. It's designed to provoke questions such as, well, in our doctrinal statements, we have something called the perseverance of the saints. Well, what does that mean? It means that saints persevere. Well, how do you know a saint? It's because they persevere. Okay, can you tell early? No, not really. A saint is someone who perseveres. Elect is someone who comes to the party. Many are called, but few are elect. The high and the low of the land were obviously invited. But who are chosen? We can only recognize them in their wedding garments. It's a funny little puzzle. And it sort of defies us, and we keep thinking about it, and it sort of keeps going down and down and down and down, and we can't quite dislodge it or resolve it from our imagination. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Peter and his practicality, which Jesus labeled as satanic. Jesus is coming to Jerusalem. This parable sort of writes itself. The Son is coming into Jerusalem, and who's going to complain? The powerful, the wealthy, the leadership. They're going to look at the celebration in the street, and they're going to say, Jesus, tell these people to simmer down. The things they're saying about you are not appropriate. They are receiving you like you're the king of Israel, like you're the prince of the city. They're receiving you like the city should roll out the carpet and we should kill the fat calf and we should all receive you. And Jesus says, if they didn't say it, the stones of the temple would shout it out. But yet, Jesus will mourn on his way into the city, because what did the king do to the cities that rebelled? Jesus will mourn on his way in on Palm Sunday and say, if only you knew what would bring you peace, not one stone will be left on another. Is Jerusalem the city that has rebelled? These questions just linger. And here's the funny thing about parables. In many ways, parables are like dreams. It's not uncommon for me, and you know, I preach a rough draft of this on Friday, and then I read the comments coming in, and I think, how's this sermon progressing? How is it forming? And you know, some Sundays you feel really good about the sermon. You think, I feel really good about the sermon. It's really going to go well. And sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't. Some Sundays you come and you think, well, how's this sermon going to go? I'm not really quite sure. And then last night, you know, I had a short night, so I had to wake up early. And so I remembered my dreams. And one of the funny things that you have, if you're not quite sure about your sermon, is that Saturday night you have dreams where you're naked and you can't find ways to hide. And so parables are like dreams, though, because you're like, well, You know, what a silly thing it is when you say something like a dream. You can sort of see its meaning, but, you know, even when you're having a dream, sometimes you're talking to someone and they become someone else, and you're doing this here, and then you're in a different place, and it's sort of like all of our internal struggles and anxieties and monologues sort of played out in a different place. And so we have this story that seems absolutely obvious. A king and a son and a great wedding and everyone should come. And we've seen Charles and Diana and Elizabeth. And for many of us, this English royalty is sort of a portal back into another age. But you don't have a wedding without a bride. And the bride isn't even mentioned. And where is the bride in this story? And who are the people? And who is the bride? The groom. Well, he's at once the groom, and he's at another time a servant who will be mistreated and killed by the members of the rebellious city. But this is a story about a king and a son, and the son doesn't do this. The story is about a wedding banquet. And so how does this work in time? Is it the church and the people? Is it Jesus and Israel? Is it something in the future? Or is it something in the past? We're not quite sure. It's sort of all of them. Because then when you have the question, who is the bride in the story? If I say, who is the bride of Christ? All of you know your Sunday school lessons and you will say, well, it's the church. Well, in some ways, the bride is the same as the guests of the wedding. But then who is the groom? And what about the cross? And doesn't the cross basically tell us the lengths to which this groom will go to win his bride? Because, in some ways, Palm Sunday will be sort of like the wedding banquet, but it won't be. And in some ways, the wedding banquet will come at the end, and we all sort of know that. But in some ways, do you need the key for that room? Sorry, I forgot to open it this morning. In some ways, the prince is on a cross. Well, that's strange. It's almost dreamlike. To what lengths will the prince of the kingdom go to seek and save the lost? To what lengths will the prince of the city go out into the world and debate with Peter and plead with the people? And even though they have all sorts of conflict, continue to meet and talk to the leaders and the officials and the nobility. And when the prince himself is hung upon a cross, his mockers will say to him, he saved others, he cannot save himself. When the truth is, he was saving others by not saving himself. You see, this parable sits and provokes us, and we begin to see relationships all over the place. We begin to recognize that this invitation given by the servants is the most outrageous thing to be handing out for free. You would imagine that the banquet would be filled and you would never, ever, ever get a ticket to see Diana and Charles' wedding. But here it is for you. There's room at the table. And you imagine that the king would be too far above everything to know anybody at the party. But there we find him mingling among everyone pulled off at the street as the guests. All of the people, all of the elements are both there and flexible, mixing in and out. And this is where parables have their punch. because we are in the story. And this strange meal we have before us, well, there's no veal, there's no steak, there's no fish, there's no lobster. This meal is available all over the place, Sunday after Sunday. Many seats are empty. Some come ready for it. Others, take it or leave it. We are in the story. The king has invited us. Well, who are we in the story? Well, I can see us as the guests, but aren't we also in some ways the bride? And isn't the prince going to great lengths to bring us to the table? And so we have to ask questions about this story, because this story is obviously clearly about response. The king is holding a great banquet. The prince is ready to wed. And like in some ways in a dream, we're the bride and we're the guests. And we're about to sit down at a table together. Are we hosting? Sometimes we host. Sometimes we're the servants who go out into the street. Sometimes we're the guests who come and sit at the table. We're also the bride that the prince goes to the cross to redeem. This is the feast. And the feast itself continues to be strange to us, as it was strange to his disciples. That meal, that Passover, that they were all gathered to rehearse, to enjoy, which they had all done since they were children, is the same night on which Jesus would be betrayed. Jesus goes to Jerusalem, times all of it, so that on the night he's betrayed, he takes bread and he breaks it. And the prince is now the bread. The prince is now the meal. He took bread and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body, broken for you." Wow. Who would the prince die for? Well, he would, of course, die for his beloved. He would die for his people. "This is my body, broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." We then get to take part as well. We become his body, broken for the world. We become the guests who had to be hauled off the street, who come into the banquet with joy. We become the bride who is adorned to receive her king.